At the words out, Christoph scowls as he decants the tray onto the bedside table. Tell me, did he pay it himself? He glares at me. I am not supposed to tell you. In blood? Yes. How much blood? A pint. The words are clipped. Jesus. Why so much? It is not a lot for a life. It is normally a finger. The door slams behind him. Why would he do it? Why would he save me at all? Why was I not dead before Yakuza came? I can understand him not conceding to demands on home turf, but why not just deal with me before? I wouldn't put it past him to have staged the whole thing to collapse my resolve. But to what end? Does he really want Snow White's services that much? If he wants someone dead, they are dead. If he says Slashdorm is finished, it is finished. There is no grandstanding. I would bet my life on it, and I've been betting my life on a lot less recently. He just saved me. For some inscrutable and subtle reason of his own. But nonetheless, he just saved me. He gave a pint of his blood for me. There is something powerful, primitive about the idea. It's inspiring. I'm grateful, eye-prickingly grateful. The day is long and lonely. I watch the door, but he doesn't come. He's out having a good time. I wash every inch of my body carefully. Then I shout. His voice sounds in the room. He is getting up. Now he's on the other side of the door.
Are you okay?
He says. I lather up the soap until bubbles run down my chest. No. He opens the door and his eyes widen. He stands staring. It's the first time I have seen him surprised. His mouth opens and closes. Snow White is hot. I can see it in his face. He comes over, his eyes wary and his expression rueful, as if he has just lost a battle with himself.
I hope you're not going to get me wet.
His fingers reach out, tracing the line of bubbles down my stomach, and I pull him against me. The water drums on our heads as his mouth finds mine. I open my eyes. Daylight. It was a dream. The disappointment is sharp. A wet dream. Jesus. Like I'm 15. Sun shines across the water. Gulls scream. The door opens and it's Christoph. Where is he? Impatience is making me irritable.
Down on the jetty. He looks worried. He doesn't really have time for this.
The wave of his hand encompasses the bed, the room, me.
He has a lot of things that need dealing with. I told him about you giving your word before, and he says I can let you out to use the bathroom.
I nod.
And he said, Christoph twists his hand, that I was to tell you that if you hurt me, he will hunt you to the ends of the earth.
Christoph, I wouldn't touch you. You know that.
Then why?
He stops. Why what?
Nothing, he says.
He unbuckles me and I fly to the bathroom window. The air is warm, the sunlight brilliant on the white. A man is climbing out of a speedboat. I squint in the bright sunlight. I can hear the shouts of greeting, laughter, warmth. They're close. Voices float up the cliff face.
Even you won't be able to sort this out. What are you doing here anyway? I can't believe you stopped the cage for some woman. World War III is breaking out and you're here messing around with some chick? What's she like? Does she throw you to the ground and squeeze you between her massive thighs? The newcomer laughs. It's not like that. Is she really here?
The new arrival is confused. I didn't think it was actually true. I can't believe this, Alec.
Alec,
I've never known you to bring a woman here.
What do you always say? Emotion is for fools. Women are weak and they make you weak. They suck you in and drag you down, surround you with their soft, billowy limbs and suck the life out of you. Boy, you must have it bad.
Don't be ridiculous.
I can hear the scowl in his voice.
A terrible premonition hits me. I peer through the slats. They round the final flight. The stranger has long, dark hair. Even in aviator shades, he is unmistakable.
Roman.
Brothers. The same olive skin and chiseled features, the laughter, the recognition. They even look alike.
I am the world's biggest fool.
It was no coincidence Roman was at the Colony Club. He had been sent to find me. It was no coincidence he turned up in a bar beside GCHQ. He was there to kill me. They stand facing each other and I'm back on the Courchevel airstrip watching two men greet each other. And I realize it's even worse. No wonder he uses Halo as his ops team. Halo is his brother. They turn and disappear into the house.
Alec and Roman Constantine. What a talented pair.
For an hour, maybe more, there is nothing. Then I hear footsteps on the stone outside. Murmured voices, serious, thoughtful. Voices that have spent an hour in discussion and are now going their separate ways. Someone is going down the cliff steps. A speedboat leaves the jetty. Have they both gone? Footsteps in the corridor. A long, quick stride. They haven't both gone. My heart beats a single painful beat. The door opens. He is wearing holsters round each thigh. My eyes widen at the hardware and I realize I have never seen him with a single weapon. It's serious.
I have some things to sort out on the mainland.
I look at his forearm. I want to say thank you for the blood debt, but I don't know how.
I am going to take your IV out before I go.
He opens the drawer and removes a dressing pad, a bag of cotton wool, surgical tape, and a pair of gloves. He disappears for a moment, and there is the sound of running water from the bathroom. Then he is back, snapping the gloves on his wrist and straightening my arm. He lifts the tape gently. I look away from the surge of blood that comes out with the needle. The tiny piece of rubber hose wiggles out through the hole. He presses the cotton wool down hard. I watch his face, willing him to talk to me.
Keep the pressure on for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I say. It's not my first time. The voice doesn't sound like mine. He sticks the dressing over the puncture wound and holds it down with the surgical tape. He turns his back, stripping off his gloves, looking out of the window.
You are free to go.
What? He releases my ankle cuffs. He bends over my body, unlocking one wrist, then the other, not meeting my eyes.
Where?
Wherever you want.
I don't understand.
I wanted your loyalty, Snow White, but I'm not going to force it. You are free to go.
Seagulls screech outside the window.
How long will you be?
I whisper.
I don't know. We'll talk when I get back.
He is looking out of the window.
If you are still here.
Then he is gone. Chapter 50. I let myself out of the room and stand in the corridor listening to the silent house. Alone. I pad down the corridor, down the stairs. Stand in the hall looking out at the sea and the jetty, and the speedboat ready to take me anywhere I want to go. The stone is gritty with sand. The memories are flooding back. I can see him climbing the steep cliff stairs in the night, his head bent to shield me from the cold. I go down through the twilight green of the basement and out into the bright light. Is this really his favorite place? The ground is baked hard, strewn with rusty pine needles. They lie in slippery pools, the earth beneath them cracked into hexagons. Pine and washing powder. The smell is comforting, domestic. I go back up the stairs to the hall. The black and white tiles are cool under my bare feet. You can go anywhere but not into the locked room. Is it a cupboard under the stairs or is it an actual room? I trace the crack around the door with my finger. The lock is small and flimsy and new. Like the lock at Henri's. It wouldn't keep a child out. He must know that. What have you got in there, Bluebeard? Is it a server room? The Firestorm hub? I go back out through the open front door. The stone on the terrace is so hot I can barely stand. The locked door watches me from the hall. The lock gives way to one good kick from my bare heel, like I knew it would. The frame splinters, the door flies back. An internal room, not a cupboard. Crammed full. Its contents glitter. I walk in slowly, right to the end. Mirrors. Elaborate gold frames, full-length dressing mirrors, wooden frames from a bathroom. They glimmer in the dim light stacked against the walls. My fingers reach out to touch a huge embossed frame. Winter stares back at me. Her face thin, chiseled after Snow White's. Her short blonde hair stands out from her head like a halo. Her green eyes sparkle. There is a thin slash above her right eye. I touch her face, her yellow cheekbones. She looks ethereal, a wild creature. I turn, and a thousand winters turn with me. He has always known, she says. Your implants came out in the camp. Chapter 51. Daylight. A new day. Still alone. I flex my shoulders, turn my neck from side to side. My ribs feel comfortable. My knuckles are healed, and the bruises on the back of my hands are turning yellow. My mind is hiding something from me. I circle round and round, not facing it. I think about all the men I have known and all the women and how they measure up. They don't measure up. I cannot hide from this. I wash every inch of my body carefully. I wrap a towel around myself and clean my teeth. My mouth still feels sore, and now I know why. I stand at the windowsill. A single speedboat is moored up on the jetty, ready to take me anywhere I like, if I want to go. In his room, I press my cheek against his pillow. What did I find in the locked room? A mystery. He patched up a government agent, set her broken arm, nursed her back to health. He protected her. He paid her blood debt. Why? I wait on the stairs, looking out of the high window across the waves. My heart thumps in my chest. A speedboat is crossing the bay with a single occupant, racing the early morning wind. The throttle chokes as it slows. I'm on my feet, swinging off the handrail, clattering down the stairs and out through the front door. The day is already warm. I fly down the cliff steps and he looks up, a question in his eyes. I stop on the jetty, suddenly shy, and he leaps out of the boat, not waiting to tie it up.
"You are still here," he says. "You didn't try to run off."
I shake my head, grinning like an idiot. Then I am throwing myself into his arms. His body armor is hard. He lifts me off my feet, swinging me round, burying his face in my hair. I can feel his stubble, and happiness bubbles through me. I pull the gun out of his right holster with my good hand and shove him away from me. His arms drop to his sides, his face set. The vein in his neck pulses. I level the gun. Time stretches out. Snow White watches us, facing off on the jetty.
"You know you said I wasn't your type," I say. He nods.
I lower the gun to my side, and then offer it back to him, magazine first, in surrender. "I want to be compliant." His face blazes with triumph. He puts the gun in its holster and pulls me roughly back into his arms, his expression full of conquest.
"There is something I need to tell you," he says.
"Later."
I turn my face up to his and he kisses me. The heat sweeps up my body, the jetty fades, the baking sun, the grip beneath my bare feet, and there is nothing but his mouth on mine, his arms around me, his hands in my hair. I skate my hands up the body armor, tugging at the straps. He gives a low laugh as he pulls away, and a moment later he is dragging the breastplate over his head. He looks around for me. He laughs when he sees me in his speedboat turning the key in the ignition.
"What are you doing?"
Even now, he doesn't get it. "It's been a pleasure, Alec Constantine."
My voice is as hard as my expression. Now he gets it.
He hurtles to the jetty edge. I am just out of reach. His eyes narrow as he measures the distance. "Don't leave!" His voice is hoarse with urgency. He pulls the Glock. "You know it's not loaded." "I know how you think." He turns to the other speedboat moored on the jetty. "You aren't going to catch me in that either. It was set up to fail."
"Winter,"
he whispers. His final card. "Goodbye, Alec."
"The world is a safer place with me in it, Winter."
"Tell that to John J. Traynor." As I open the throttle, the last thing I see is him standing on the jetty, his face full of anger and frustration and sadness. Finally, finally, I have learnt. What did I find in the locked room? Myself. Chapter 52. The welcome committee on the flight deck of HMS Albion salute as I leave the Chinook, like I'm a national hero. God knows what Simon has said to them. I am a strange kind of passenger in a t-shirt and bare feet. They marshal me straight down to medical. They have diverted HMS Albion. They have pulled it from its patrol of the Mediterranean, its search for asylum seekers braving the waves. They are so worried about reprisals that they hijacked a battleship to bring me home. It will turn up in Portsmouth months before it was supposed to. How do you hide a woman? Dress her like a chicken and put her on a boat with a load of other chickens. The onboard sick bay is just like every other berth on a battleship, and nothing like the white sterile GCHQ detention floor. The chief medical officer is a commander with three gold bands around his cuff and the two crimson stripes of his profession. He is bluff and cheerful with fat sausage fingers. He gives me the once-over, checks my splint, checks the implant scars inside my mouth, and takes my blood. Trace morphine, nothing else. I tell him about the knockout gas and the dex and the amobarbital, and he purses his lips. The young SBA comes in carrying a pile of uniform. She looks at me from under long lashes.
Is there anything else I can do for you? Anything at all?
I consider this carefully. No, thank you, I say.
You are to report to the incident room, she says, for debriefing.
I stare down at myself in uniform. The boots are awful. I've never wanted to be in the military. There is a cadet outside my door, like I'm a prisoner. He escorts me down the metal corridor, up ladder stairs, along another corridor, and holds a door open for me. After you, ma'am, he says. The ops room is about a quarter of the size of the GCHQ incident room. A man with captain stripes is standing by a monitor. He shakes my hand. Captain, I say.
It is an honor.
He sounds like he means it. He sits me down at the terminal and logs me in, and a moment later, control is on a screen tapping the microphone.
Is it on?
He's talking to someone off camera.
I will leave it to you, the captain says.
Control is smiling.
From the beginning, Winter, he orders.
So he killed John J. Traynor, he says when I'm done.
No doubt about it. I've seen the murder weapons.
So when did he blow your cover?
I shrug. I must have cracked under the ammo barbital. He looks down at his notes.
If you had ammo barbital, it would be in your blood work.
You never had it.
My guess is you had a general to take your implants out and set your arm.
Which means he knew before that.
He is smiling so much I can actually see teeth.
Unnerving.
He was waiting for you. The cage was the obvious place to come at him. He was expecting you to come in on your knees, services for sale. I'm betting they ran DNA on every woman in the place, and there you were. Not a hooker, a hood, a perfect DNA match.
The blue pill. There was arnica on my back when I woke up in the trailer park.
He probably went to put a bullet in you. There you were, unconscious and naked from the wire search, and he reached for the first aid, not the Glock.
Dumb decision.
Maybe he wanted to see what you would do. He could have pulled you in at any time, after all. I'm sure he didn't expect you in the cage.
That's why I walked out of the holding cell scot-free.
I leaked your full file after Courchevel. DNA, everything,
Control says.
He was intrigued. It's lonely at the top.
I don't believe it. You knew I would go rogue.
It's why I hired you.
Alec Constantine fell for the oldest trick in the book.
Only a woman who walks on both sides of the moral divide could have pulled this off. You have always been conflicted.
Jesus.
You will succeed Eric as head of field, and my number two.
He smiles, seeing me speechless.
It's good to see you all grown up, Winter.
What happened to Slashstorm in the end? I say.
Nothing. Control waves his hand dismissively. It is an irrelevance. We'll get a lot more data later, obviously.
Later?
The live transmission.
The room rocks. For the first time, I actually feel like I'm on a ship. I pull up the Slashstorm homepage, my heart hammering. 12 faces, 12 counters spinning so fast the numbers are unreadable. Business as usual. Millions and millions and millions of people voting. The betrayal feels like a body blow. Slashstorm is in perfect working order with 6 hours to go. I swallow hard to stem the rising panic. So, what have we got?
Control waves his hands again. It is irrelevant.
You mean we've got nothing?
Control shakes his head. We'll get a lot more from the actual event.
What? So, that's the plan,
I'm struggling to keep my voice level. We wait for someone to be tortured to death to collect the live data. My sinuses burn. Control's voice is hard. One life. You, of all people, should be able to see the bigger picture. Once we have Alec Constantine, we will dismantle his sights one by one. He's not behind it. He pretty much told me it wasn't him. It's not the first thing you admit to a woman you are trying to seduce. I scowl, leaning into the screen. It wasn't like that. I was chained to a bed. He could have had me any time he liked. Control looks at me like I'm missing the point. I'm not talking about sex, Winter. I'm not his type. He said so. It's beside the point anyway. I pinch the bridge of my nose. Men are monsters, but that doesn't mean they have to be monstrous. If anything, he was trying to fight it. He told me it was finished.
Irrelevant.
I am coming back to London now. I will run the incident room on this.
Fine. Control sits back. The war is won, Winter. This is just one life. Collateral damage...
I switch him off mid-sentence. It takes a while to get me airborne, and the frustration pulls and claws at me until I'm a bundle of bad-tempered nerves. Why did I think I could believe anything the Prince of Darkness said? The blue of the med shimmers below us. The countdown clock is showing 4 hours. 12 faces stare out at me from my laptop. I can't explain the feeling of betrayal. I shiver in my combats. The Osprey is empty except for me and the pilots. An unscheduled run to London. The buffeting, grinding roar drills into my skull, throbbing behind my eyes. My sinuses still burn. I study the faces again, one by one. I can feel myself ranking them in preference order. The girl with large brown eyes stares out of the screen at me. I picture the knife getting to work on her, slowly, lovingly sliding under her skin. A scream crawls up my throat. Please, not her. If I had a phone, I would be dialing the vote counter now. My gut twists in self-disgust. It is exactly this sentimental human trait of choosing and empathizing that has made Slashstorm the success it is. We just can't stop ourselves having favorites. I go back to assessing, like a policeman. I blow the images up, analyze them frame by frame. The same room, the same chair each time. One after the other. Definitely a mirrored room. Perfect for this kind of camera show. I worry at them like pieces of a jigsaw, turn them round and round, pick them up and put them down again. We are hugging the Spanish coast. A strip of blue meets urban sprawl. My shoulder straps bite as we accelerate. A military helicopter hurrying me back to the incident room to watch a murder live and do nothing to stop it. I know Alec is not behind Slashstorm. He has a moral code and it stops short of torturing for entertainment. But what made me say he was fighting it? It turns on its head everything we have assumed. The Prince of Darkness as dark policeman. He killed Dominique Saint-Vere for crossing the line. So why did he kill John J. Traynor III? What had he ever done? And why did he do it himself in such a brutal way, as if he were sending a message? Men are monsters, but that doesn't mean they have to be monstrous. Leave that to the women. I turn the idea round and round. The grey of the channel, foam-flecked, flies past, bringing me closer to London and the cold incident room. There is rain up ahead. The countdown is moving towards the final hour. The digital clock fills the screen. I'll be lucky to make it to GCHQ in time. Already the tracers will be in place, the analysts at their monitors. Max scowling over the data feed. A problem to solve. All around the world, people are getting ready to watch the show. Maybe they're watching to see if their favourite is safe, maybe to see who got the fewest votes, to see who was the least popular. But they are watching all the same. I stare at the screen again, willing it to show me something no one else has seen,
I can smell jasmine in the cold closeness of the helicopter. A phantom nasal hallucination. I hate mirrors. They show your real self. As if your face is a mask, and the mirror you is the real you. Something clicks. I sit, frozen, staring, not even moving my eyes, trying not to lose the feeling. It is there at the back of my mind. Adrenaline floods me. I know something. My brain flails, searching. I can't pin it down. I can't grasp it. Elegant fashions, a little too precise, a little too cut out and static. A mask. The sensation of an outer shell, a wooden cover, while the real face lies behind. A forest of silver aerials, high-tech transmitting equipment on the slippery grey of the wet roof opposite. Someone bends over me, engulfing me in jasmine, her hair curves down either side of the back of her neck. Blunt fingernails run over my naked body. In a corner, a camera on a tripod films the scene. A fist, slippery with oil, pushes inside me. Her exposed spine is knobbled like some prehistoric creature as she leans over me, spread-eagled beneath her. I'm watching from above, looking down on my unconscious self. I am staring up at a mirrored ceiling. I have been in the Slashstorm room. Chapter 53. The Osprey curves a wide arc as we burn the turn, the grey of the channel flying by as we swoop low, streaking back the way we have come, back towards Paris, my heart pumping louder than the thudding rotor blades. 15 minutes to go. The thin grey line of motorway leads straight into the heart of Paris, even with the auxiliary tanks we were running low on fuel. Now, with an unscheduled 50 miles added to our journey, we are flying on fumes. I shrug off my shoulder straps and buckle on the harness. The pilot is navigating blind, following the Seine. The Eiffel Tower glints in the sun. I clip on and throw open the door. The wall of air hits me hard as a fist. Ice cold. 2,000 feet up. It's like Toy Town down there. I move my wrist in a circle, ordering him lower, the buffeting wind drowning my words. The Haussmann grid system is identical across the city. On my laptop, Slashstorm starts its 60-second countdown. I get ready, check my buckles, check the line. There is no one to control the winch, no one to slow my descent. It is going to burn like fuck. Air traffic control scream in the cockpit. The radio blurs with urgency. An unscheduled flight path right over the heart of government. They will be scrambling fighters. The pilot catches my eye as I hang over the edge. Then I am gone. I fly down towards the fairy tale rooftops, the wire skinning my palms. It is worse than I feared. I land heavily, the line dragging me towards the edge. I brace against the parapet. My hands are raw and bleeding, my fingers numb and useless as I fumble the release. The line flies free, and I throw myself across the rooftop to the fire door, slipping and sliding on the slick surface. The heavy door is cold against my burning palms. The door is locked. I press my forehead to the cold metal, frustration stinging my eyes. Behind the door, a girl screams. The metal vibrates with it, desperate, panicky screaming. Think. In a gap between the spires, I can see the forest of aerials. Disrupt the signal, kill the transmitter. I half slide, half scrabble my way down into the gully. The evil bit of metal vibrates under my sore fingers. My palms sting. The aerial hits the roof with a clang. I scramble back to the door. The screaming has stopped. Sobbing. Someone is climbing stairs in a hurry. I pull myself round and up onto the ledge above the door. A shape on the roof opposite catches my eye. Alec is silhouetted against the skyline. My heart thumps once in recognition and the feeling of betrayal evaporates. He has a semi-automatic slung over his shoulder and he watches me impassively. The fire door crashes open and a hooded figure comes out wearing the dusty black robes of the Slashstorm contractor. How did we not notice the size before? How delicate the gloved hands are. The door stands open below me. The sobbing is clear now. The figure picks its way carefully across the fairy tale terrain. Bare feet. She throws back her hood. The Marquise is scowling. Her perfect swinging hair hugs her jawline. The heavy hood frames her face. She could be arriving at the opera. A woman, not a man. I will never listen to psych profilers ever again. She slips and slides across the rooftop just like I did. Her feet are bare. She pulls the transmitter upright, resets it, and turns back. Now excitement gleams in her eyes. Her face is alive with brilliant, vivid vitality. The mask is gone. Anticipation hums through her like Christmas morning. I jump down from the ledge, barring her way. Rage flashes across her face, forked tongue and malevolent, and finally I understand this woman, and I'm glad I don't have a weapon. I want to use my fists. The strange grey eyes slide over me, lingering on my mouth. My skin crawls. She comes a step closer. "I know you," she says. Her head tilts and her tongue comes out as if tasting the air. "You are different." Her hand reaches out towards my lips. "I never forget a mouth I have had." "Why did you leave him alive? That wasn't part of our deal." "New deal," I say, and punch her in the face hard enough to break her jaw. My skinned palm screams, but I don't care. The need to take her down burns through me. She stumbles backwards, scrambling across the slippery terrain, terror and realization lending her speed. The scrabbling reminds me of someone else on a rooftop, long ago. She slips and slides, trapped by the steep slope of the gully, the folds of material caught in the forest of aerials. The robe comes free in my hands. She backs away. I stalk across the roof like a hunter with a wounded doe. "Who are you?" she says. "A monster." I hit her again and again. Her face is broken. This is why Alec uses knuckle dusters. Fists don't do enough damage. I drag her to the parapet, her bare feet kicking and sliding. I pull her to the edge, to the row of low columns, and up onto the stone. Now I understand what it was in Ferret's eyes when he thought of the Marquise. It was fear. Her blunt fingernails claw at the ledge, a frantic, desperate fight for her life. Terror gives her strength. I hold Alec's eyes as I shove her over. He hasn't moved. There is a sound like a gunshot as she hits the cobbles, the sound of a skull hitting stone. I put my palms on the balustrade, breathing hard, and the knowledge hits me. I killed her. Because it needed doing. Behind me, the sobbing starts again. The fire escape stands wide. Somewhere in the house, a girl is sobbing in heart-clutching fear. I lunge down the stairs, following the sound. I am on the floor with the ancestral portraits in the thick carpet. A door stands open. Mirrors. A room panelled in mirrors. A girl tied to a chair. I fall to my knees at her feet. "Who are you?" I say. "Where do you come from?" The wide brown eyes stare, unblinking. I take in the ill-fitting clothes, and suddenly I know where she comes from. "I am Trainer Trust," she says. Of course she is. I get an image of a body beaten to death with knuckle dusters. John J. Trainer, the missing piece in the Slashstorm jigsaw, an endless supply of teenagers we couldn't trace. I get to my feet and turn to face the camera. The red light of live transmission winks. Blood from my palm drips on the parquet. The girl's eyes are wide. My name is Winter, I say to the millions watching, and you are done here. I lift the camera off its stand and hurl it at the wall, and the mirror shatters into 1,000 crazy paved fragments. My skinned palms burn as I tear at the cords binding her to the chair, my raw fingers clumsy. She tries to stand, but her knees buckle out from under her. I lean down. Her arms go around my neck and her legs hook my waist. She is surprisingly light. I edge out onto the landing. The house is silent. Dust motes dance in the shafts of sunlight. The smell of jasmine is everywhere. The need to get out chokes me, and I throw myself down the stairs, taking the opera red carpet at a run. I try to put her down to open the street door, but she clings to my neck, hanging on my hip as I wrench the lock, and then we are out in the fresh air and the world is full of approaching sirens, a street away at most. The door of the house opposite creaks under my hand. I slide through and shut it quickly behind me, just in time. Cars screech to a halt outside, shouts, running footsteps. The other side of the door, the emergency services are arriving, but in here, we are protected, isolated, cocooned in soft, dusty silence. The stairs flex and shift under our combined weight, but somehow the creepiness has gone. Maybe it's the warmth of the day. Sun pours through the dirty windows. I call as I climb.
Alec!
My lungs heave. My thighs burn with the effort of running up 6 flights with a girl in my arms. The bearded man stands in the doorway as I hit the top landing. Adrenaline spikes. Where is he? His eyes are on the girl.
He said you would come in time. He said no one would get hurt.
I might have known Alec would come himself to clear up this mess. He is running for his life, and he still came. He said Slashdorm was finished, and he meant it. I should have trusted my instincts. I should have had more faith. How long was he here? He shrugs.
I don't know. A while. Long enough.
Did he say anything else about me? He shakes his head. I elbow the fire escape door open. The rooftop is empty. The sirens from the street are loud.
Alec!
I shout to the wind. He has gone. Why did I think he would wait? Why did I think he would want to see me? I slide down the slick gully onto my bottom, the girl still in my arms, my muscles shaking from the adrenaline come down. Chapter 54. They are waiting at the end of the King's Cross Eurostar platform. Viv is smiling. Simon is sniffing. He holds me at arm's length, scanning me.
You look great, he says. The hair suits you.
Elfin. He picks up a bandaged hand and turns it over. Then he lifts my splint, weighing it. Are you done? I say. He grins through his tears.
Welcome home, he says, throwing his arms around me.
It is afternoon by the time we get to the city. A warm afternoon. Bank interchange is swamped with girls in strappy sandals and guys in shirt sleeves. Reception freeze at the sight of me, and then carry on as if they haven't noticed. I picture the word going out. She is back. She is back. Security are deferential. We clear biometrics in record time. No one has to say it. I take the lift straight up to the top floor. Control smiles at the sight of me, his number two, a national hero, suspended within 24 hours of being appointed. Marseille, I say, I need to go back. I want to make it right.
Okay, he says, in a week or two, if there's still no contract out on you. Control knows what Snow White did.
I nod. It's more than I had hoped for.
Right now, I want you here. You have a job to do. You are the UK's first line of defence.
I'll be making some changes.
No more Marines. Control raises an eyebrow. You have something else in mind?
I think about a teenager carjacking a Renault.
Yes, I say. I want people who will do what needs to be done. God forbid, says Control.
I lean up against the wall, looking out through the circular window. How's it going with the French prosecutor? He allows himself a thin smile.
Self-defense, he says. I laugh out loud. Self-defense, he says firmly. You were unarmed, frightened, judgment impaired by days of captivity, brainwashed by the Prince of Darkness.
Alexander Constantine thinks he is above national boundaries, Winter. He thinks he can make his own laws.
He has to make his own laws. I stare out at the junction. Pastel shirts wait at the crossing. Now is the time to mention I saw him in Paris. Outside the Bank of England, the early edition of the Evening Standard is being unloaded.
They have raided every address he has ever been associated with. A 1,000-acre ranch in South Kazakhstan, a townhouse in Atlanta, a flat in Moscow, a castle in Umbria, an island in the Adriatic. His homes are in smoking ruins, but they haven't found him. Facial recognition software combs the planet, peering out of millions of cameras.
Looks like we've avoided another contract on you. He's too busy running for his life to worry about yours. Langley thought they had him in New Zealand, but it was a red herring. We'll find him. You know that. The world is a very small place once you know who you're looking for, and we are seeing unprecedented international cooperation.
He smiles thinly like he finds this funny.
Kazakhstan are still holding out, but they'll come round.
No extradition treaty.
It's immaterial anyway, he says. No one wants to bring him to trial.
Kill squad.
Where are we with Firestorm? I say.
Should be down by the end of the week. No one figured Kazakhstan.
A cyber backwater.
What do they have? Uranium? That's about it. Which is where he got started, incidentally.
Control's attention flicks away from his screen.
Worst case, we have global support to landlock.
Landlocking. Shutting an area out of the internet. Impossible with a country like Russia. Just about doable with Kazakhstan.
Powergate have requested your presence.
Control allows himself another small smile.
Check in with medical first.
Clearly the satisfaction at being able to brief the NSA hasn't worn off.
What about Slashstorm?
He waves his hands dismissively.
Finished. It was just the two of them, using the kids from the Trainer Trust orphanages. The other 11 kids have all been identified.
The Marquis and John J. Trainer. I wonder how they found each other in the first place. And I know the answer to that. What does the internet do? It brings people together. It makes the world small. The Marquis is dead. John J. Trainer is dead. And two wardens of children's homes founded by John J. Trainer III and administered by his charitable trust are dead. I know it is Alec, and I have said nothing. The press is full of outrage at the vigilante justice, and my guts twist and turn with an awful kind of understanding. I have put him under a death sentence, and he is doing what he can while he's still alive. Behind Control, the moths flutter their desperate dance against the pheromone trap. There are even more than before.
Chapter 55. Medical is the same as ever. Bright white lighting, disinfectant, fear. The young doctor with a clipboard looks at me.
It's have a splint removed.
I nod. Tell me Everard's not here. He shakes his head. Dr. Everard is over at the other facility. He ushers me into one of the side rooms. Medical couch, huge circular lamp, rotating cutters. The minor injuries repair suite. He gestures to the bed, and I sit down on the paper, stretching out my arm. Elastic snaps at a wrist, and my eyes prick, and suddenly I am back in a white room with billowing drapes. Dark eyes flecked with gold stare down at me. The doctor has finished laying out what he needs. He pushes a plastic bin over to the bed and picks up a tool. The mini-rotating drill whirs into action. I feel a sudden, irrational urge to stop the drill, not to lose this thing he did for me. What is the matter with me? The drill screeches and squeals as it hits the splint. Disintegrating plaster of Paris falls into the bin. The doctor's short blue fingers pull at the cracks until they are wide open. There is white muslin underneath, wrapped around the arm, protecting it. I was unconscious when it was put on. I missed seeing long fingers expertly bandaging. He pulls the arm straight. I stare at the ceiling. His breathing catches, sucks in. His heart rate rockets.
Whoever put this on has left something behind, he says.
My eyes snap open, my heart thuds, my breathing gulps. There is a raised red square under the skin. The medic hits the panic button as he backs out of the room. The door slams and the seals activate. Containment protocol. Standard procedure for a suspected biological weapon. Now I know why there's no contract. A remote access detonator, rigged to blow when the splint came off or in response to a remote signal. Delayed gratification. In no time at all, Simon's anxious face and messy hair is peering through the square glass in the door. The internal phone rings. I sit up slowly and stand.
Yeah? Everard is on his way. He says to keep it still.
Okay. I hang up and go back to bed, staring down at my forearm. I wipe my cheeks with the back of my other hand. I am not crying in front of Everard. It is 30 minutes before I hear something outside the door. Then the seals are breaking, and the door opens, and in walks Everard, tailed by Simon. They are mid-argument. Everard scowls. It is entirely unnecessary for you to take the risk. The door reseals behind them. Winter, Everard says, his blue eyes a bleak Siberian wilderness.
Doctor, I sneer the word.
His cold hand lifts my arm. He stares down at the wheel. He presses it with his nail. His sculpted lips purse. Looks like a tracker. He wheels the portable X-ray machine over to the bed, fiddles around setting it up. Tension pours off Simon. Everard, not so much. His fringe flops over his face. Keep still, he says. And they are out of the room and the containment seals are back up. The X-ray machine does its thing and Simon gives me the thumbs up through the door. They've got what they need. Now comes the waiting, the analysis, and then more waiting. I lie back down on the bed and stare at the ceiling. After a while, the strip light burns holes in my retinas. I squeeze my eyes shut against the blobs of black. It is 25 minutes before the door opens and Simon comes in,
covered in smiles.
It's nothing, he says. A well-being tracker, monitoring your vitals. Nothing to worry about. Not the sort of thing we use in the security services, developed for the civilian market. They can have it out in 10 minutes. He shakes his head. I think Everard's disappointed it's not going to disperse anthrax in your system. He grins. Simon finds Everard funny. He has no idea. The door opens and Everard walks in. Do you know what they call this tracker? The Wife Watcher. The 21st century's answer to the chastity belt. It monitors endorphin levels. It rings an alarm for extreme pain or pleasure. Will he know the splint is off and I found it? Simon looks uneasy. Probably. Possibly. In theory. Pressure sensitive. It is a reasonable guess. That's if he's still watching. He's got no need to tag you now. Why would he be watching? He's running for his life.
He was watching in Paris. That's how he knew I would make it in time. I swing off the bed.
Where are you going? They need to take it out.
I curve my hand over the tracker protectively. No. Chapter 56. I kick my jeans into my locker, button up my silk shirt, strap a knife holster to my thigh, and pull on some hold-ups. My fingers trace the raised wheel under the skin on my wrist. I wriggle into a pencil skirt, shrug on my suit jacket, and check my knives. No guns. The NSA take a dim view of weapons in their building. Security at London's biggest server farm and the European headquarters of the NSA in Canary Wharf is long and painful, and ends with the usual argument about my knives. They have found all my knives, and the one on my thigh. I don't know why I bother trying. They put the tagged plastic bag under the counter and watch me like I'm some kind of urban legend, something that might blow at any moment. I turn my back on them and wait. The lift doors open and my escort appears. It isn't the usual flunky deputized to escort VIPs. Hi, Brad, I smile, my mood lifting fractionally. It is so good to see you, Winter, he says, enveloping me in Chanel bleu. I kiss him gently on each cheek. Security watch disapprovingly. Brad's face is pink. We get in the lift and he presses one of the basement levels. I lean my shoulder against the wall. I still can't believe it about John J. Traynor, he says. Yeah. The details that are emerging about his predilections have shocked an unshockable generation. Sometimes it's hard to know who the good guys are in this business. Jesus, I can't believe he had a Nobel Peace Prize. Brad shakes his head. The lift doors open and I realize where we are. We are on the incident floor, the NSA equivalent of the GCHQ incident room. This is where they run live ops from. My breath hisses out through my teeth. What's up? Why are we down here? It's only right that you're here, he says. We found him. My heart thuds a single painful beat. He opens the door. The room is full of analysts manning terminals. Screen after screen shows a fortress in a desert. Another shows a Chinook interior full of men, a dark ops squad. On the big screen, the Langley incident room. I recognize the man in the corner of the picture, James McKellen, the director of the CIA. Where? I ask. Turkmenistan. 8 hours ahead. It's 4 a.m. in Turkmenistan, exactly the time to strike. Operation objectives? My mouth is dry, my voice a long way off. Shoot to kill. Estimated time of arrival? He gestures at the screens. The Chinook has 9 minutes and 56 seconds to destination. I squeeze my eyes tight against the burning. In the Chinook, they are pulling on gas masks. What are they using? He tells me. 3-mile dispersal radius. We're taking no chances. It was dropped an hour ago, just reaching maximum dispersal.
I look round the room at the intent faces. I am finally going to get to watch him die. And I don't want to. I stare down at the tracker in my arm, my brain slow. The gas may not have made it into the building. Is he asleep? Vulnerable in the dark. The tracker will ring an alarm if I experience pain. I need a knife, fast. I pick up a fountain pen from the desk and flick the lid off. 7:46 to destination. I brace myself against the desk and jam it hard under my arm. The axillary nerve. My knees buckle, the room swims. I close my mouth on the scream, the nausea rises. Pain is going to make me black out. I fall back against the desk, but I keep the pressure up. The pain goes on and on while I watch the seconds tick down. Beside me, Brad is fixing on a headset, taking a call. An internal call. She's here. He nods in understanding. Send it down. She can't leave the room right now. He hangs up the call. There's an urgent parcel for you from DCHQ, he says without taking his eyes from the screens. The door opens. A flunky stands on the threshold, a white GCHQ internal envelope in his hand. A small gold shape falls out of it onto the floor. A single Hershey's kiss. Black bubbles pop in my vision. My legs are weak. I stare at the chocolate. Then I am backing out through the door, bypassing the lifts and staggering up the fire escape concrete stairs. Security gape as I hurtle through, not stopping for my knives. I vault the turnstiles and screech to a halt beside reception. Who delivered this envelope? She shrugs. Some guy. Where is he? I slap the envelope down and snap the words out. I don't know, she says, holding her hands up like I've pulled a weapon. I slam out through the weighbridge onto the street. It's still light. The evening chorus of songbirds shriek their heads off. Plane trees line the street, their leaves a thick canopy overhead. There is no one here. I spin on the spot. A taxi is idling up the street. I sprint up the road and hammer on his window. He lowers it, questioningly. Did you deliver this? I hold up the packet. He nods. I sag. My forehead touches the glass. I slide onto the back seat. And he pulls off. I rub the tracker reflectively. Where are you taking me?
I don't know, he says.
His voice is all South London taxi.
I just follow the sat-nav. You have to give me your earring?
I unhook my GCHQ locator and pass it through the little window in the glass. He unscrews his cigarette lighter, pops it in, and screws it up again. We take the slip road down to the A2 going north, not the Blackwall Tunnel. That rules out everywhere south of London. We pass the ArcelorMittal orbit, the Olympic Stadium, the Arc of the Velodrome. The traffic is light, and I peer out into the evening wondering if anyone has noticed the taxi, if anyone has noticed me being carted away by organized crime. Who else knew about the Hershey's? I feel the belt round my left thigh, missing its blade. I wish I'd had a chance to pick up my knives. Unarmed and off-grid. Dual carriageway, knackered tarmac, a sign for Kelvedon. The A12, north of Chelmsford. There is absolutely nothing but East Anglia this way. Miles and miles of sugar beet. I tap on the window. Where are we going? His shoulder lifts, but he doesn't answer. South of Ipswich, we turn off onto the A14 and the bleak industrial wasteland of the Shotley Peninsula. And now I can make a good guess. Container lorries keep pace with us. The road skirts Felixstowe town centre, funnelling the traffic round through the marshy wasteland,
onto the flat, man-made dock of Felixstowe Harbour, the UK's biggest container port. We stop at lights, and then more lights, as we funnel forward into queues. I knew Felixstowe was a big port, but I had no idea. Mile upon mile of container parks and quayside, with loading cranes like Big Blue Meccano. Corridors of rusty painted boxes, yellow, orange, blue. Costco, Maersk. The smell of sea and shipping seeps into the cab. We drive through the queues and through the loading bay, and come to a stop beside a ship the size of several icebergs. She looks loaded and ready. The cab door opens. "Where do I go?" I demand. He shrugs. I climb out of the cab and close the door, and he drives off. I swing round. There is no one here. A forklift stands abandoned, reminding me of the quayside in Marseille. It has to be the ship. I stare up at it, rising high above the dock. A gangplank leads to the front deck. I take it in long strides. The containers are so tightly packed there is barely room to walk down the side between the wall of metal and the edge. The deck shifts beneath me, like it was just waiting for my arrival to cast off. There is nothing to see. Rusty container after rusty container, no one around. I swing round the end of the ship. 24 containers end on, 8 high. I step back, scanning the wall of locked doors. 192 locked doors. My eyes sweep left and right. Something jars. A discordant note, and my eyes snap back along the sweep they've just made. In the middle, one row from the top, a yellow container has its door ajar. My heart starts to race. I walk to the side of the ship and scale the container, hand over hand, hitching my skirt up until I'm right on top of all the containers. I straighten up. We are several hundred yards out to sea. I hadn't even noticed us cast off. The lights of the port twinkle behind me. No going back now. I pick my way across the container roofs until the yellow one is below me, slide down the top layer, push the open door wide with my boot, and drop down. It is empty, except for a figure leaning against the far wall. The most wanted man in the world. Chapter 57.
Hello, Winter.
This man has every reason to hate me. This man who beat 12 men to death with his bare fists. Tiger eyes glitter. Behind me, the boom of Folkestone Harbour echoes out into the night. The stained metal creaks. Why am I here, Alec?
You are here to surrender.
This guy does not give up.
What do I have to do? I've choked you, axed you, knifed you, and made you the most wanted man on the planet.
He folds his arms.
Why did you keep the tracker, Winter?
So you could find me.
So you could lure me into a trap?
Obviously. I fold my arms back at him.
How'd you explain what happened at 7:55 p.m. this evening?
The tracker alarm.
You experienced intense physical pain, he continues. Self-administered intense physical pain. 5 minutes to touchdown.
Cutting it a bit fine, I thought.
Triumph blazes on his face. It blew all the lights on your tracker.
Why was that, Winter? I walk into the container, back him up against the end wall and catch a wrist in each hand. I slam them against the metal. I can feel his heart beating. Maybe it's malfunctioning.
You'll have to do better than that,